This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 22nd episode. For this month's podcast, we review a JCENM article aimed at uncovering care gaps in primary hyperparathyroidism in a large healthcare system. As is usual for these observational studies, we carefully consider the study design with its intrinsic limitations to help us better analyze the conclusions that the investigators draw. Joining me today on the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast are two excellent and well-known endocrinologists. First, as a brief reminder, I host this podcast, but my day job is at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where I'm a general endocrinologist, medical director for our clinic, and an associate director for our fellowship program. Our regular contributor today is Alan Dalkin from the University of Virginia. His long career in endocrine education includes having been the fellowship program director at UVA for many years, having served on the residency review committee for the ACGME, and helping the Endocrine Society develop many educational products, particularly the endocrine self-assessment program, the ESAP. His clinical expertise in calcium and bone metabolism makes him particularly well-suited for this article. Our guest expert today comes to us from the Maine Medical Center. Cliff Rosen directs clinical and translational research there, having also founded the Maine Center for Osteoporosis Research and Education. His research in bone disease is extensive and well-published, and he has held many editor roles, including a current role as an associate editor for the New England Journal of Medicine and a former role as an editor for the JCENM itself. I excitedly welcome these two today to the podcast. Everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. Today, we look at systems-level opportunities in the management of primary hyperparathyroidism, an informatics-based assessment, which was published in December 2021 in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. This paper comes to us from the Endocrine Surgery and Endocrinology groups at UCLA with Nardine Dawood as the first author. At this point, I'll hand things over to Alan. He will start our discussion by reviewing the author's introduction, along with Cliff and he highlighting key concepts in primary hyperparathyroidism in general. Alan?
Thank you, Chase. So let me start off just kind of running through a little bit about hyperparathyroidism and the way the article's set up. I'm going to get Cliff's input on a couple of items, and then I will turn it back over to Chase. So it starts with basically the issue that primary hyperparathyroidism is probably the most common cause of hypercalcemia in the ambulatory setting. Over the years, the incidence of primary hyperparathyroidism seems to be increasing. That may be multifactorial, in part related to more inclusion of calcium in chemistry panels and ambulatory tests in general. And it may be that there's an underlying increase in the incidence of hyperparathyroidism as well. I certainly have seen an ever-increasing number of referrals over the course of the last number of years, and I think probably it's worth getting Cliff's experience in this area as well at this point. Cliff, if you have any comments on that, would be
no, great. I think you're absolutely right, Alan. It's hard to tell whether the incidence is increasing or just our ability to find it earlier is increasing. But as you probably know, the character of primary hyperparathyroidism in 2022 is different than the character of primary hyperparathyroidism in the early to mid 1900s. Much more severe then than it is now, much more mild, and more screening calcium tests for sure.
Yeah, I would say that's true. The number of people that come in that are asymptomatic, that is, that the hypercalcemia is picked up on a routine laboratory test, seems to be ever more prevalent than the historical person with a kidney stone or a fracture. To get back to the article, the evaluation of hypercalcemia is pretty well worked out, certainly for the audience listening to this podcast. First step is usually to repeat the calcium level and make sure that it's not a laboratory error, to check an albumin level and correct for that, or to do an ionized calcium test. I don't do particularly many of those. Mostly I wind up with the albumin level, but certainly some places will do a very good ionized calcium test. And then that's followed up usually with a parathyroid hormone assessment. That is a measurement to see what the PTH level is in the presence of hypercalcemia. In the broad sense, patients, when they're entering into the workup, really fall into one of three categories. There are the classic primer hyperparathyroidism patients. Those are individuals who have an elevated parathyroid hormone level in the presence of clearly elevated calcium. There's a sort of intermediate or in-between group of people that have clear hypercalcemia, but their PTH level is normal. And the authors in this paper call it normal hormonal hyperparathyroidism. It's essentially a parathyroid hormone level that one would predict would either be suppressed if the cause is something that is non-parathyroid, or frankly elevated if there is a parathyroid adenoma or other primary hyperparathyroidism. And then the third category of hypercalcemia that the authors addressed here were those individuals in which there was a suppressed parathyroid hormone level, low or detectable, but below the lower limit of the normal range. In the patients that are symptomatic with a history of sequelae from the hyperparathyroidism, such as fractures or kidney stones or progressive renal insufficiency or peptic ulcer disease, most of us generally refer to a head and neck surgeon, whether it's a general surgeon or otolaryngology surgeon, for parathyroidectomy. In my practice, I tend to get an imaging study done first of the neck, usually an ultrasound, occasionally a nuclear scan or 4D CT, depending on if they've had prior surgery. I guess I'll let Dr. Rosen comment here again in that regard in terms of what his practice is.
Definitely getting the parathyroid hormone. And then usually if they're de novo, I usually do an imaging study. The surgeons have different preferences, but for the most part, radio image scan is the most likely choice of doctors. Some want to use ultrasound, but sestamibi appears to be the most common. A couple surgeons I've run into actually also do CT scans. I agree with you, though. In primary hyperparathyroidism that's symptomatic, generally the size of the parathyroid adenoma is significantly greater than it is with normal hormonal hyperparathyroidism. And so there are some surgeons who choose not to do localization.
We're lucky here at the University of Virginia. We have a number of excellent surgeons that are more than willing to do a neck exploration without having preoperative imaging.
I think, Alan, that's a good thing that we have to think about here is that particularly, and we're going to think about this more as we go further on in the article, but the more we think about picking up earlier forms of disease, I think we have to realize is that the clear benefit drops a little bit, particularly just like Cliff outlined from 100 years ago when disease presented almost always in its severe form, to the further that we push along that spectrum to where we're finding it in its most mild forms. We, first of all, have to be really careful not to make assumptions about benefits that we know from much older data. But I think the other thing that you also already alluded to here with the surgical intervention is be aware that when it's a less obvious single parathyroid adenoma, that potentially complications and side effects may be increasing for sure if we have to think about more frequent foreground explorations here. So this is going to come up, but I think this is definitely something helpful that we need to keep in mind as we go along.
I think the other issue, though, is normal hormonal hyperparathyroidism. There, I think it's almost obvious that the individuals will order a scan to sort of confirm the diagnosis. Now, I don't like to think that a scan will confirm a diagnosis of primary hyperparathyroidism, but on the other hand, localization that's concrete and well seen and well visualized is very reassuring to the primary care provider, or in most cases, the endocrinologist. A negative scan raises doubts, and we'll get into this about what happens to these people, why most of them don't go to surgery. And part of it is the anxiety of the endocrinologist about the definitive diagnosis.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that this article is really going to focus primarily on the asymptomatic individuals rather than the ones that there are. We will get into the data, and there are patients that had fractures. There's patients that had kidney stones and such. But the vast majority of this is looking at how do you evaluate the patient with asymptomatic hypercalcemia, and is there an opportunity that is lost in many situations in terms of identifying those individuals who would benefit by further management? The things that the authors looked at included things such as renal function and nephrolithiasis and bone density, as Chase alluded to in terms of their outcomes. So I sort of summed up the purpose of this article really was to use a large database, a cross-sectional analysis of a large database at an academic institution to evaluate the presence of repeatable or repeated documented hypercalcemia, and then to determine whether those patients were managed in a particular way to first identify the etiology, potentially hyperprimary hyperparathyroidism, and second of all, to find out whether they were then evaluated in terms of downstream sequelae of that primary hyperparathyroidism itself.
Thanks, Alan. So what we'll do is now we'll do our usual slow walk through the methods here. I think in particular, the methodology that these investigators use will really help us understand what conclusions we need to be drawing from this. So first of all, as is usual, we're going to think about the specific study design. That's of a retrospective cohort study. So that's how the authors describe their investigation. We'll get to this towards the end of the methods. I found it helpful to actually think about it in a few different ways, but the authors do describe it that way. That's the main way that they approach their data here. So as a reminder, a cohort study is when you have multiple groups of individuals, and the way that you put these individuals into different groups is based on an exposure. And when we get to this, we're going to have to think very broadly about exposure. Often when we think about exposure, we jump right to a medication or environmental exposure or diet or exercise, something like that. This will be a little bit different, the way of thinking about the exposure, but I still think that framework is really helpful. And then once you split individuals into a group, it's either different degrees of exposure or exposed and unexposed. They are then followed over time. That's what makes it a cohort study, is there's a time component. And what you're looking for is the difference in one group versus the other of how frequent an outcome occurs. And some of these outcomes, Alan already alluded to some of them just a little bit ago, will be relatively obvious ones that we would think about. Some of the terminology here, again, a little bit unusual, but still keeping that framework in mind of exposure and outcome, I think will be helpful of keeping all of this data straight. And what makes this a retrospective study is that this study was started after all of the data is collected. So the authors are not following these patients, these subjects in real time. Data is already there. They're going back into their database to pull all this data. So just the important thing to highlight there is you are limited to whatever data is available. Because it's not prospective, you can't define up front what information you're going to obtain. You're stuck with whatever you've got, and you have to deal with that. Okay, so that's a retrospective cohort study in general. So now we're going to dive into this paper and see how the authors use that study design to come up with their conclusions. So as was alluded to already, so this is a large study. This comes from UCLA. These are patients who were seen in the UCLA Health Network, so a large tertiary medical care center. And what it included was it involved screening of the electronic health record and identifying those with repeated instances of hypercalcemia. So when they looked for this, they found quite a few individuals, well over 3,000 individuals, adults above the age of 18, who had two or more instances of hypercalcemia. They were looking for repeated instances of hypercalcemia within a six-month duration. And this data came from sort of the very beginning of 2016 all the way up through 2018. Now, they did exclude a few people for several good reasons. So one, if there was any evidence of substantial kidney disease, they defined that as a GFR less than 30. So they excluded that to try not to muddy the water there with secondary hyperparathyroidism because of kidney issues. They also excluded individuals with immunosuppression. And the idea, as the author said, they wanted to make sure these weren't renal transplant people and thought this was a fairly effective way of making sure they didn't have those individuals included. They also did not want to include anybody who had already been diagnosed with primary hyperparathyroidism and was just undergoing regular monitoring. So they wanted people who did not have an identified underlying condition yet. So those folks were all excluded. And then what they did is after they identified these individuals who repeatedly had hypercalcemia, they looked to see as if they also had a measurement of parathyroid hormone, a PTH, within a year of one of those measurements of calcium. And I wanted to stop here and get Cliff's input on that definition of the timing there. So, and then the authors later on, we'll think about this later, but in their discussion, they say, well, with a regular flow of primary care patients, hypercalcemia got identified. And for those whom the primary care provider decided to do something about it, it was come back later, measure a PTH. And so they often weren't on the same day. But Cliff, what I was curious about is they said it just had to be within a year. And so I understand it maybe needn't, it'd be okay if it's within a few weeks, maybe even a few months. But boy, up to a year separate, at least to me, jumped out as maybe a potential issue if those are not nearly proximate in time. But what are your thoughts on that? Any issues, concerns there at all?
I'm shocked that only half the people had a parathyroid hormone level measured. That to me is just shocking. Now, This is the limitations with the retrospective cohort study. We know very little about who the doctors were, whether they were endocrinologists or primary care doctors, but they have persistent hypercalcemia documented on two determinations and not do the first screening step, which is this parathyroid mediated hypercalcemia, seems quite astonishing to me. Temporally, I agree. You would think that at the time of visit, if they're measuring a calcium, they would measure the parathyroid hormone on follow-up. So yes, that does seem a little strange, but the point is they went through the records and found that up to a year, they were looking for a PTH level. The other thing is it's not surprising in primary care to have a PTH buried somewhere in the records of an individual who is ongoing follow-up, might not be concurrent with the most recent calcium. So I can appreciate that. I think it becomes an issue when we think about normal hormonal hyperparathyroidism, because that's where trouble begins. In terms of trying to understand the pathophysiology, they get one PTH level, it's normal, and off there to the races, they're just going to follow this hypercalcemia. So yeah, I'm surprised. I think it becomes a bit problematic to search. I've had referrals where I've had a search through the record. There's got to be a PTH somewhere. And oftentimes it's actually quite a bit in the distant past, especially, you know, if it's not flagged in the medical record and it's a primary care physician, they may just walk away from that. But I'm sure Alan has some thoughts.
Well, there's a couple of points here. First, I've been generally impressed that the PTH levels stay relatively stable over time in hyperparathyroidism. Yep. The calcium levels, especially when it's mild hypercalcemia, some days it's a little high, some days it's a little low. So right. I was a little concerned that it was too separated by a great vast time, potentially vast amount of time, because sometimes that second measurement may be normal and they still do have primary hyperparathyroidism. So we may be missing some that way. I agree entirely with what you said, Cliff, about the PTH levels and the normal hormonal, because again, while it does vary a little, if you're slightly elevated one time, or their cutoff is a pretty strict guideline or number of 51 in their assay, if it's 53 one time and 48 the other time, yeah, it gets to be a little more complicated in terms of what category they put them in. So I was not so worried about the two measurements over the course of a year, but I agree with your key point was you'd like it to be more proximate to the calcium. I think that would be right.
I think the other thing is that a good dietary history is really important to interpret both a calcium and a parathyroid hormone level. And we rarely, if ever, see documentation of any of that, particularly in a somewhat suppressed PTH with evidence that they could, in fact, have persistent hypercalcemia. That dietary history is really critical, or urinary calcium to creatinine.
So I think that's helpful there. So a couple different things. So sure, yeah, probably not excited about how far apart it is possible for the calcium and PTH to be. But as Cliff pointed out, we'll actually look at this when Alan gets to the data here in a second. But there were hardly any people who, as it was, had a measurement there. And if they used a much more conservative measure, could be even far fewer people. So may just be one of those pragmatic choices that had to be made there. And I think similarly, as Cliff has already suggested, might be some other data that we want to have here that we don't have. But it is the reality of a retrospective cohort study is you are stuck with whatever data there is, and you've got to make the best of that because it's not prospective. You can't define what information you want to get, and such information as dietary history is often not obtained, or at least well documented in any easily identified manner in the electronic health record. So moving on in the methods here, so we're going to get to how different levels of parathyroid hormone were defined. So Alan's alluded to this already, but patients were stratified into four different groups. And we'll get to in just a second how this is used, but quickly, the different groups were a low PTH. So again, everybody who had repeatedly high calcium and then had a PTH check, it could be low, so less than 11 by the assay that was used here. It could be normal, which at this lab was 11 to 51, or it could be elevated, 51 being the upper limit of normal, so above that would be elevated. And then another group, again, we're going to look at this, who never had a PTH measured, or at least not within a year of having had the repeatedly high calcium. So then as discussed as a group here, so these labs are maybe, these cutoffs are maybe a little bit different than a lot of places typically, or at least it's classically what's described as low is somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20. So maybe this is a little bit lower than a lot of the assays that are out there. And 51 also seems a little bit on the lower side of what would be typical, where I think a lot of assays are 60s, 70s, maybe even 80s would be the upper limit of normal. Any comments from you two, Alan or Cliff, about that? Or just this is the way it is. There's regional fluctuations and every lab defines what their normal is and not really a big deal here.
I don't think it's a big deal. My rule of thumb is that if the PTH is suppressed to below 11, I'm very worried in persistent hypercalcemia about hypercalcemia malignancy. That's one of the best markers of very suppressed PTH in the absence of calcium excess or milk alkali syndrome or vitamin D intoxication. That's very worrisome to me, and I'm almost inclined to immediately do myeloma workup and also lung to determine if they have an ectopic source that's driving hypercalcemia.
That's helpful, and we'll look, Alan will walk us through those numbers. Not a lot of people in that situation, but it was part of the group. Okay, so finally, one other piece of information that's helpful, particularly as we think about this as a cohort study. So bone mineral density was recorded if it was either done prior to the hypercalcemia identification or within 2 years of follow-up. So with that, how I would put that together, there's a few different ways of thinking about how this study was designed. Again, the authors described it as a retrospective cohort study. I found it helpful, particularly when I looked ahead to see how the authors presented the data, is actually thinking about, well, there's a couple of baseline analyses that I would suggest that maybe fit a bit more of the cross-sectional analysis. Again, it takes part of this larger cohort study, but with the way that the information is analyzed and the conclusions that are drawn, I would suggest thinking of those as cross-sectional components before the retrospective cohort study started. So how I would think about it, the first one is that when they looked at all of the individuals who had hypercalcemia, they looked at those who had a PTH measured and those who didn't. So that was really just a cross-sectional look to say at a single point in time. Again, there was a broad definition of when those labs could be done, but there really wasn't a following people over time. So that was kind of a cross-sectional component. And then additionally, among those individuals who had hypercalcemia and then had a PTH measured, you could split into those different categories of low versus normal versus high. So that served to some degree as cross-sectional, and I think gives us a lot of helpful information. Where we really start saying, okay, well, what is the retrospective cohort component of that? That's actually when they split people into groups who had the calcium is repeatedly elevated and a PTH measured, and they particularly were looking at those who had a normal PTH versus the high PTH. They followed those individuals over time. And in particular, what they're looking for is, did these individuals have a bone density scan performed, a DEXA scan performed, and did they have osteoporosis diagnosed or treated? Either way, what would count as an individual having an outcome of osteoporosis, or did they have a parathyroidectomy? So we have to think about this a little bit weird. The exposures here are purely, did you have labs measured, and then to some degree what they were. But a lot of this is just looking, did you have a lab checked, yes or no? And then the outcomes, some of them are more classic outcomes that we would think of, osteoporosis or parathyroidectomy. But in this study, even just further investigation, such as a bone density scan, a DEXA scan, would serve as an outcome. So we want to think about it this really flexibly so that we can understand how this data is analyzed. But this is the way that this study is set up for us to take a look at. So now that we've had a good look at that, I'm going to turn it over to Alan. He's going to actually walk us through these numbers again, some of this cross-sectional stuff, so we understand what things look like at baseline. And then as these individuals are followed over time, how frequently they have these outcomes of interest. Alan?
To go through the results as best I could decipher, they identified some 3,100 plus patients with hypercalcemia, persistent hypercalcemia, which roughly 60% were Caucasian and 60% were women, which I would say is very typical of my practice here at the University of Virginia. The average age of those patients was a little over age 60. Again, that's pretty typical. Sometimes it does get a bit older, I think, in some regards, but certainly postmenopausal Caucasian women is over age 50, classically, is the presentation. So of the 3,150 plus patients, roughly half of those really had a documented PTH measurement, some 1,526 individuals. Of those, 50% were in the classic primary hyperparathyroidism range with an elevated PTH. some 40% had the normal hormonal hyperparathyroidism, so a normal PTH, and 10% had a suppressed PTH that was below 11. The authors did note that if a patient had a pre-existing diagnosis of low bone density, those individuals were more likely to have PTH testing than if you had no previous measurement of anything to suggest calcium disturbances. For the 1,500 or so patients that did not have a PTH level, interestingly, they tended to be a little bit older. And I think both Dr. Rosen and I would say that the older you are, in some regards, the more concerned I am, especially if the PTH level is normal or lower, that there's something else going on. I thought it was interesting the calcium levels were on average higher in the individuals that did not get a PTH test, which makes me really wonder if there was an endocrinologist involved anywhere in the care of those individuals. But the calcium level they list is 11.8 in the non-PTH group and 10.8 milligrams per deciliter in the PTH group, which is a significant difference. And then if the patient had a prior diagnosis of low bone density, as I said, there was a significantly higher incidence of getting a PTH test, roughly twofold higher chance, although still only about 35% of those individuals with a previously documented low bone density and hypercalcemia had a PTH test. So despite the higher calcium levels in the non-PTH tested individuals, there was a lower incidence of nephrolithiasis in that group, which didn't sit well with me. It doesn't make any sense. There are patients that have hypercalciuria disproportionate to their hypercalcemia, but generally in my experience, the patients with the more marked hypercalcemia have the more marked end organ issues, whether it's nephrolithiasis or bone loss.
I agree completely. I think PTH actually preserves calcium in the proximal tubule, but over time, as you build your calcium level in your serum, that overfloods the system. So yes, the more severe the hypercalciuria, the more likely those individuals are to have kidney stones. And of course, that's on a chronic basis. So I agree completely. Higher blood calcium would predict higher nephrolithiasis.
I think one of the parameters that they could have looked for, although I suspect it probably was not done frequently, but it gets at your point about nutritional status too, is a 24-hour urine calcium assessment. Yes. This would have been a perfect adjunct bit of data to match up with history of nephrolithiasis or some of the other parameters here, but there's no mention of that having been done. So of the 1,500 or so patients that did have a PTH measured, those individuals were more likely to have a bone density done in the subsequent 2 years. They were more likely to have medical management for their low bone density, and they were more likely to have been sent for parathyroidectomy and neck exploration in the subsequent 2 years as well. And the final points I think to make on this were of the patients with the classic primary hyperparathyroidism, hypercalcemia dyad, 22.8% of the patients had subsequent BMD testing, which is really low in my opinion. That really is below what I would think would be standard of care. And it should be almost probably 80 or 90% of individuals probably should have had bone density testing. And only roughly 19% of patients underwent parathyroidectomy, and the authors listed their criteria for sending patients for parathyroidectomy and felt that some threefold higher numbers of patients should have gone for surgery. So that data is in table one. So Chase, if you wanted to turn it back to you to talk about the discussion point.
So what we'll do is I'm going to summarize at a very high level the author's findings here. Alan just walked us through a bunch of data. So we're going to put that together. And then what we're going to do I think the authors do a really good and interesting job of trying to draw implications from this. So this is observational data. And then they try to say, well, what are we going to do with this? Is this actionable? How do you actually make changes that are needed here? So Alan and Cliff have already pointed out that a lot of what was done here is not consistent to a high degree with what is recommended in the guidelines. So how are we going to try to close that gap? And I think the authors do a very interesting and even provocative job of trying to make that case there. So we're going to think about that. So first of all, to focus on the author's conclusion, so these are how the authors summarize their data. First of all, they say most individuals with established hypercalcemia did not have a PTH checked. And then further, they said those who had a PTH checked also had more workup and treatment. So I think not surprising there, if a primary care provider or someone else went that next step, they were more likely to keep on with further investigation. though they point out several other things, that a third of those who had this established hypercalcemia and had osteopenia or osteoporosis, so some bone issues, did not even have a PTH measure. So a minority, but a sizable chunk there. And that of those individuals who had labs that were consistent with primary hyperparathyroidism, most of them did not undergo a DEXA scan or have any treatment for bone issues. And this was even worse if the PTH was normal. So several different high-level findings there, conclusions from those findings. And so the first implication that the authors state is that these findings highlight system-level opportunities that exist between the observed and the ideal diagnostic and therapeutic management of primary hyperparathyroidism. The authors make some more specific recommendations later on, and we'll wrestle with those a bit more. But I think we would all agree with that. There are well-established guidelines for primary hyperparathyroidism. Alan's referenced those already. And that this is clearly outside of what would be recommended there. So the first thing that the authors want to do is they want to try to provide some potential explanations for that. So they acknowledge that their investigation wasn't designed to try to figure out for sure why this happens, but they wanted to attempt to provide some explanations for why it might have happened. The first idea that they propose is that of cognitive overload. And they say this happens, particularly primary care providers, they are overwhelmed. There's a ton of information, particularly in the electronic health records. So much data is being thrown at them. It's very easy for that to be too much, and you can't pay attention to everything. So you've got to choose some things, or maybe not choose, but you have some things that get ignored. So maybe that's what it is. They also suggested that maybe primary care providers are attributing this to physiologic fluctuations, and that even though these individuals who were included had repeatedly high levels, that perhaps that was missed again in all that data that was coming through. And finally, they also suggested, well, maybe it's the largely asymptomatic nature of these individuals, is that maybe these patients feel fine, they don't have any complaints that we would likely associate with hypercalcemia, and so that's why these abnormalities were ignored. And so I thought it would be helpful here for us to think about as a group anything else that we might suggest a little bit before. Actually, Alan had suggested one thing of, well, we don't really have information on albumin and ionized calcium. The authors do point out later on in the discussion that this is a limitation of their study. I'd say it's possible that if primary care providers actually had access to that data, that maybe those are normal. So maybe the primary care providers have more information to act on and are appropriately saying, no, they don't actually have hypercalcemia. It seems unlikely that would be a majority of these patients, but it might be some of them. Alan, any other thoughts that you might have before we get to Cliff on other potential explanations for why these individuals are not getting appropriate workup?
Well, one of the things that I thought of, and it actually applies here at the University of Virginia too, is there is definitely a backlog in terms of getting patients from primary care providers to subspecialists in many areas, and that includes endocrinology. There just is not the capacity to take the burden off of the primary care providers in working a problem such as mild hypercalcemia. The wait is long. The patients don't want to wait 4 months or 3 months to be seen. And I would have thought that perhaps would have made some comment about life and practice of medicine at UCLA and whether there was any issue there or not. So I think that would be part of it. Also, there's been, at least at UVA, the use of e-consults, which is a quicker, sort of down and dirty, simple question sent directly to the subspecialist for issues exactly like this. I have a 68-year-old woman who has a calcium level of 11.1. What should I do next? Or do they need to go to the endocrine clinic? And that facilitates the care of some of these asymptomatic, otherwise healthy, pretty straightforward problems. Cliff, maybe you can comment on
what. Oh, I agree completely. 30 years in the VA system, and those e-consults are fantastic. And you're absolutely right, Alan. This would take a lot of pressure off the primary care doc. We don't know that from these retrospective reviews. How many got e-consults, do we? We just don't have any insight. But I think that is the case. And I agree that the overload is probably the major reason that they're, you know, asymptomatic. They have 12 minutes to see a patient. This is clearly not on their radar, the patient's radar screen. So I think it's a skip over.
And and Alan had suggested this when he and I were looking at this article, and our initial analysis of this is wondering, we don't have great insight if any of these people saw endocrinologists or how many of them did. We think it awfully unlikely that that you could get through one of our offices and not get a PTH checked, but it might be helpful information there, particularly to try to understand how much of this is falling on primary care and how much of that were they potentially thinking would be done by a specialist if there are delays that may be happening there. So that is another potential explanation, at least in part. So now let's get into a couple of claims that the authors make here, some of these implications that I think will be helpful for us to wrestle with. So the first one to think about, and I'll quote here that the authors say, when physicians forego PTH evaluations, patients become increasingly vulnerable to the healthcare costs, morbidity, and mortality associated with subclinical bone disease. So I want us to think about that a little bit more, because where the authors are going is that we really need to be thinking about how to get more testing done because patients are going to suffer otherwise. And that's what I want us to think about. So Alan and Cliff, thoughts on that, really pushing for systems-based approaches that is going to substantially increase testing for what are largely asymptomatic people. Yes, there are some people who have disease. If they pointed out, we know some of these people had osteoporosis, and almost certainly a lot more would if it had been looked for. But with that systematic approach, thinking of a lot more testing, a lot more people who will undergo potentially surgery, largely for an asymptomatic group here. And how do we think about that claim without supporting data? So for example, that you think about a really high level supporting data would actually be a cost benefit analysis to formally evaluate, is this something for a healthcare system to do that's going to make sense? But thoughts about that claim made by the authors?
I think there's a general pushback in primary care and also among patients that the less testing, the better. PSA is a good example. A lot of people just don't want to go there because it's a sump and you're all of a sudden getting into more testing and more testing. And I worry that that's the case here, that they just don't want, either the patient doesn't want to get a bone density. Why do I want to know? I feel fine and the calcium's stable. It might be a little high, but it's stable. But also the physician. I think there's a tendency now among primary care physicians, the less is better, and maybe we should not go there. I can follow them. If it gets worse, we'll take a look. So I think a systems approach to try to deal with that is very appropriate, because I think in this particular instance, the bone density becomes the real hook, because there is something you can do for somebody. If you're going to operate, you're going to improve their bone density and reduce their fracture risk. So the end game is a little clearer, I think, but I'm interested in Alan's thoughts.
I completely agree. And even if you don't do surgery, there's plenty of data with bisphosphonate right. therapy and hyperparathyroid bone disease. So there's definitely something to do. I think it's a missed opportunity at the least to not push forward at least a step. I'm not saying send everybody to surgery, but I think an assessment, assuming that the system can support that, I completely agree with you, Cliff, is completely indicated at this point. It's a miss. It's a missed opportunity.
And so we'll think about that a little bit more with this next claim. I'll say, first of all, Cliff, I really liked your analogy with the PSA, because I think it highlights a few different possibilities. Maybe primary care providers are being inappropriately swayed by saying, well, PSA testing was thought to be great in the 90s. And then we looked at it and decided, maybe that's not a great idea and we're overdoing it. And so maybe there was a lot of carryover, and so they've started to do things in other areas. Or at the same time, it's very possible, we don't know this, it's possible that a similar analysis would say, whoa, maybe we shouldn't be doing so much testing, because if you actually did a formal analysis, we would realize how much harm's being done here. So I think you could argue either way. We don't know as it is, and we'll come back at the very end as to what more information we might want to know to really be confident here. But I do think that's a helpful analogy to make.
If I could make one additional point, which I think Cliff touched on, which is, I think, really important. There's an education of physician opportunity here that he brought up that I think you can't oversell. There's just clearly a missing component in terms of understanding what is the implication of that result. And that part, almost to some extent, in my opinion, almost falls on the endocrinologist, the person that's referred to educate the primary care providers who are getting the patients de novo and knowing what to do with that result. I think we own part of it in the end.
All right. So the other claim that I want to take a look at, another one by the authors, and I'll quote here, far fewer patients with normohormonal primary hyperparathyroidism versus classic primary hyperparathyroidism underwent parathyroidectomy and may therefore be more vulnerable to the end organ skeletal and renal sequela of untreated disease. So I wanted us to think about that. I do like, has been suggested already, is that the authors really focus on osteoporosis and nephrolithiasis as a couple of clear outcomes that we have good data that suggests that surgical intervention makes a difference for. But I want us to think about that, particularly as we think about, as we push more and more towards the mild end of disease spectrum, is that that benefit becomes less obvious. How confident are we that really intervening on folks who, yes, the PTH is inappropriately normal, but it is such mild disease that they don't even have a PTH that's above 51 in this assay? How confident are we that this would really be making a substantial impact on disease, or do we just say we don't know?
The implication is then that the PTH dictates the severity of the disease. I've always sort of looked at it that the calcium dictates the severity of the disease, in at least in my opinion. And I think, although Cliff probably knows this well better than I, there's ample data that in patients with normal hormonal hyperparathyroidism that truly turns out to be primary hyperparathyroidism, they can have relatively significant end organ sequelae from that.
Alan, good point. And table one is illustrative if you think about it in a different respect. That is, how much different is normal hormonal PTH from classic hyperparathyroidism? And here you have 600 subjects plus in each group, and the complication rates are the same. Nephrolithiasis is the same. Fractures are actually higher. GFR is almost identical. So I'll make a confession. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, with John Bilzikian, and we worked closely together, I didn't believe at all in normohormonal hyperparathyroidism. And it stuck with me for quite a while. But recently, I have become a converter. And I must say I was wrong initially. And these data really prove that out. I mean, that's not the thrust of this paper, but that to me is a nugget that's really, really important.
Before we wrap up, we'll quickly touch on some of the limitations. And these are ones that the authors mentioned. We've alluded to some of them before, but I think it's helpful to outline them here. So first of all, they mentioned unmeasured confounders. And I'll say as an aside that that's always an issue with observational data. We've mentioned a few things here. We don't really know why these people were getting some of this testing done. We don't know who had evaluations done, say because they had nephrolithiasis or for other reasons. So a host of potential unmeasured confounders. But I think the way that the authors focus on this is trying to identify those characteristics. Gaps, I think, maybe lessens the impact that has. It's maybe not quite as important why the abnormality, the hypercalcemia, was identified here in the first place, just the gaps that occurred after that. So that's one. Other ones that the authors point out, that there could be errors in coding. So always an issue when you're looking at observational data that depends on ICD-10 coding. They point out, as we said before, that ionized and albumin-corrected calcium, they were not available for this investigation. Also, as we pointed out, the asynchronous nature of the PTH and calcium measurements in most of the patients, those weren't collected at the same time. They point out that medication could have an effect. So thiazide and bisphosphonate, for example, could affect the calcium levels. They do point out, as we alluded to earlier in the methods, that they have patients who have a PTH that at most assays would consider to be low, but theirs was not. So this 11 to 19 range had 163 patients. So certainly a minority of the group that they looked at. So you could look at that differently depending upon where that testing was being done. And then finally, they point out that UCLA is a high volume surgical center. And so that's possibly predisposing individuals there to have a parathyroidectomy. So even though most of these individuals who met criteria didn't have a parathyroidectomy, that actually may be overrepresented and may not be represented of a larger population that's not at such a high volume surgery center. Alan and Cliff, we've talked about some limitations and given our thoughts already. Anything else that either of you would add to the list as provided by the authors here?
I just want to say that I came in a little skeptical. I'm an editor at New England Journal. Our retrospective cohort studies to me are not the gold standard. But I think that both in this discussion and also reading the paper very carefully, I think there's some real importance for clinical endocrinologists here. And there are several signals there that either we're not doing the right thing, or maybe we don't promulgate our guidelines appropriately. editing a series of guidelines from John Bilzikian now in the Journal of Bone and Mineral Research on guidelines for managing hyperparathyroidism. And it seems to me that we really have to go a lot further in helping our primary care docs recognize. This is pretty astonishing to me. One of the easiest things to do in endocrinology is to get a PTH level on somebody who's hypercalcemic. So we're not doing our job, I think.
Yeah, we'll look at that summary here. The authors, that's exactly where they go, which I really like what they do. So we'll think about that here in just a second. But first, Alan, any limitations that you would add before we do that?
I think we've touched on whether there had been an endocrine consult or some sort of a involvement of a specialist, I think would probably be, in my opinion, the one, along with maybe the urine assessment, even if it were just a spot urine calcium. Any attempt at deciding whether the patient had hypercalciuria, those are the two things that I think were missing that they could have at least made an effort at trying to identify.
So now let's go to the summary. Cliff's alluded to it already. And again, I'll quote here. Our study demonstrated a clear disparity between the diagnostic and therapeutic guidelines generated at the specialty level and their implementation in primary practice. And just like Cliff said, I really liked how that was phrased, is as they step aside from a clear argument of saying that whether the guidelines should be implemented here, I think that is something that we would favor, but the authors recognize that their data doesn't clearly support that. But what it does support is that the guidelines that we have established are not being carried out in primary practice. And so we've got to grapple with that. We either have to say, well, maybe our data is not strong enough to where we know that those guidelines should be applied that broadly. Or if we think that they are that strong, we need to say, wow, we have a huge gap here. And there's really no reason to think that the gap that exists at UCLA is any better anywhere else. And then I would say likely, editorialize here, likely worse at a lot of other places. And so we've got to grapple with that one way or the other. So their implication, the author's implication, they say that introducing an alert in the electronic medical record for further testing of undiagnosed primary hyperparathyroidism, as they say as an aside that they are actually doing at UCLA, may circumvent the advanced skeletal and renal sequela of the disease. So what we're going to wrestle with that implication and see if we agree with that in just a second. But before we get to that, Alan and Cliff, just thoughts overall about the quality of this report. And Cliff, you've alluded to it already, that you thought there were some really helpful findings in there. But any other thoughts overall about the quality of this study?
No, I think Alan made some points that are really relevant. It would be helpful to look, particularly urinary calcium creatinine ratio, because this is a very valuable data set. You have an established diagnosis of primary hyperparathyroidism, either normal, hormonal, or classic. And so I think there's a lot of richness in this set. And you might expect that that's another paper that they're going to put together for us. So, but there's a lot of missing elements. What about 125 vitamin D? How often do we measure it? You know, is that consistent with renal nephrolithiasis, et cetera? So,
yeah, I completely agree. I think that there could be a little bit more in that regard. I also would appreciate both of your inputs in terms of having a EMR fire an alert to a lab result. We only get about 4,000 of those a day now. So it, at least here, we use Epic, and that is, it's a wonderful tool and been very helpful, but the number of alerts that you get on a regular basis for this, that, and the other thing is huge. I have a feeling there'll be a desensitization, but maybe you...
I think that's a great place to end, because that's already getting at an implication here. So I think there's a couple different things that we can think about. Again, I want you two to wrap up here. Okay, so do we have enough information to change? And if we're going to change, what we do, is this the way to do it? So again, as I alluded to before, if you're going to say system-based change, you're going to, if this is effective, if your intervention of this alert is effective, you're going to get a lot more people tested. It's going to be a lot of people who are likely to be on the relatively asymptomatic or completely asymptomatic side of the spectrum, because they're not getting tested otherwise because they don't have symptoms. So you're going to get a lot more testing. The cost is going to go up substantially, and potentially having a lot of people have more intervention to where you don't necessarily know for sure that there is a benefit in this specific setting, in this screening setting that you're doing. And so do we have enough data to say, yes, this is something that we should be doing? And then I think the flip side is also true, thinking about this particular intervention. We're already worried about overload, a cognitive overload, the workload that providers are having to do, and then having even more alerts on top of that. Is the, what's that going to do to the quality of life of the individuals who are getting this? Is it going to wear off? Is it eventually just going to be like one of the other alerts we get that tell us that our patient's weight hasn't been checked in a while, and so we really need to make sure that our insulin dose is appropriate? Or you could think of 100 other examples that we get. So let's end with that. Alan, let's start with you. You've alluded to some already. What else do you think, other information that we need to make a change to our systems, or do you think we have enough already? So we'll get your thoughts, and then we'll finish with Cliff after that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to tackle it on a local basis. I just think that as specialists, it just emphasizes even more how important collegiality, interprofessional activities are, medical grand rounds, divisional grand rounds, and other materials, and things like Cliff is doing in terms of society guidelines and just general practice pattern recommendations that really need to be properly advertised, stressed how important they are, that even at academic medical centers where there's current information, there is clearly the opportunity for a pretty substantial gap in patient care that I think we have the opportunity to get involved in and fix.
Good. Cliff, your thoughts? Yeah. Do we need more data, or do we have enough to start making changes based on that?
I think we have data. I think we have a significant amount of data. I mean, there's probably regional variation. But on the other hand, when you think about it, this is an academic medical center. This came from UCLA. And so it strikes me that this is a more educated group, that we're probably underestimating the severity of the issue. And I think we do need to do more. You know, I am an editor in this particular area and up to date. And I always wonder whether people really read up to date when they're thinking about this, or are they just going there and asking one specific question? Because everybody subscribes to it, everybody goes to it. But it certainly doesn't look like we're, you know, we've created nomograms at up to date for hyperparathyroidism, hypercalcemia, PTH, first thing. It doesn't look like it's happening. So I think it is time to rethink how we do things. And Alan's absolutely right. The collegiality is really important. And, you know, at the VA, the e-consult as an endocrinologist, I much rather get an e-consult from somebody that I can elaborate on electronically than having to have them wait in the queue for 6 months for me to see them. I think if we ever did a survey, that the internists or the primary care docs would feel the same way. Don't do this or do this. And these are the things they want. They want immediate answers. They want gratification for what their question is. And the e-consult helps that tremendously. I don't think the alerts help. I agree with Alan. I think Epic is so overloaded with things, it doesn't work well.
And with that, I would like to thank Alan Dalkin and Cliff Rosen for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal today and know you all did as well. Please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.